Okay. Questions? Yes, sir. Yeah, it's been growing ominously. Well, it's been growing. Did I say the final is going to be on Thursday? I trump over registrar. So, we should talk about the final. Yeah, but I mean, the homework has to be due. I mean, I would be happy to make it due the class before. I thought you wanted it to be due as late as you want. So, yeah, that's. And then ask you to submit the grade. That's also nice. Other questions? There is a question regarding homework final interaction, presumably. But any other questions? Okay. So, like I said, the homework four is gathering marks. There it is. And it's like you notice that there is a 7 and an 8, and I have more space. Essentially, I'm not going to have separate homeworks. All the stuff for learning I'll throw in the same homework. And more likely than not, I'm going to probably get you to play with some Java applets for the learning problems, just the way you did for the Bayes network. Okay, since you're not going to write code, at least you should do something other than just calculating by hand. Okay. So as I say, and I also said that, in fact, I think this is not closing on 23rd. And so these are all wrong, actually. I'm going to change all that. Whatever I said in the email basically was that finally the homework would be due on the last day of class. And I'll keep adding problems up until that point. And I'll keep probably like 3-4 days final. Between the last problem and the end. But I'm not guaranteeing a 1 week heads up. Okay, so just get going with the problem. Okay. Then project 4, as I said, would be the last coding project. And I gave a bunch of instructions. I guess some of the people are already done. Others, if they need, they can read up what are the possibilities if you need extra time. Makeup class is tomorrow. In BYENG 210, which is not in this building, it's in the other building, it's in the brickyard. It's basically right next to your instructional lab, the PC lab, and on the same floor as the advising center. Okay, and it's the same, class time would be the same, 140 to 255. The last question, of course, is in terms of the final. I have two choices. Choice one, in class on 7th, which I mean, if we have an in class, if we have a proctored exam, it would be on 7th because that's the only time that I know for sure all of you are available. That's the registrar allowed time. Okay. And choice two is take home, and if it is take home, then I'll give it to you probably on 7th or 8th, and it will be due a week after that, close to a week after that, okay? Not exactly a week. I need to have time such that I will be done grading and submit the grade before I skip down, okay? Normally, I let people decide which one they want. I mean, I can't have two different exams, one for people who want take home and one for people who want in class. My own choice is very clear. I like in class. It's much easier to grade. White pages are so much easier to grade than filled up pages. So, if I have a vote, I vote for in class, but I don't. Should we take a vote today or should we take a vote next class after you think about this? Today? Okay. all in favor of in class, which is basically the usual time, and all in favor of the, and you can't vote for both. All in favor of in class. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Raise your hand well so that I can count. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay. All in favor of take home. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 17, 18, 19. Okay, first of all, 19 plus 7 is 26. We have 39 people in the class. So these guys are in big trouble. What? What did you say? Undecided. Yeah, I mean, I did not say there was another choice such as no exam. So, this is excluded middle. So either there are actually people who are missing, 13 of them, and I'm going to be, I guess, they're going to be sorry that they didn't get to take part in the democratic process. either way, they say, I mean, decisions are made by people who show up. So you guys showed up, you made the decision. So it's going to be take home, and I'll give exact details, but it's not going to be in class on 7th. Yes, sir. It's going to be highly biased towards the stuff I haven't already tested. Okay? Let me put it that way. So it's not going to be normal distribution of half for the first half, half for the second half, because first half has been more than well tested, I think. You guys did it in the class, you guys in the home. If you still didn't get it, you know, you're in trouble anyway. Yes, sir.
So do we meet after a week here, or do we give you the exam if you're
out? I'll find out. I mean, you basically just drop it off. You know, you don't need to meet. Yes. What?
How much harder?
It's too late now. It's like before voting for the president, you have to ask if I vote for this guy versus that guy. You know.
You must know that there are certain people who haven't decided.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It does not matter. I'm sorry. If 5 people show up in the U.S. presidential election and some crazy guy gets elected, we pay for it. That's it. You know, democracy is for people who show up. Not for people who stay at home, you know, or who say, let me see whether I'll get a better choice, you know. The choice is what you have, you know, this is it. So, I mean, there's so many lessons in this class, including democracy lessons, but, you know. Anyway, yeah. Other questions? Okay. I'm pretty sure a lot of state secrets regarding exam might be divulged tomorrow in the makeup class, but never know. And the recorder might be malfunctioning during that time. So I hate giving talks to empty rooms. So I hope some of you will show up. Okay, so we defined inductive learning problem last time. We went on and on and on and on and on. Only few slides. There was learning slide, there were dimensions of learning slide, there were what sorts of things can be learned, what components can be improved. By the way, it occurred to me, I don't know if you guys were paying attention, the people who voted for in class, that's a very useful piece of information. Inductive learning, classification learning, we described the problem and we talked about k nearest neighbors, and what else did we talk about? We spent the time talking about differentiating how do you evaluate a learner, and we talked about the learning curves, and then we talked about what's a reasonable goal in designing a learner, and we talked about probably approximately correct learning. At that point we ended. Okay, and so in some sense basically we're pretty much ready to get going on inductive learning. We did enough introductory stuff, so it seems as if we should just get going. You know, we have training examples, we pick the best hypothesis, and we're done, right? So let's get started. So remember that examples of learning tasks include learning essentially can be thought of as a function learning. It can be thought of as, so for example, here are a bunch of points. What is the function that these points correspond to? Here is one function. Here is another function. Here is another function. Which one is the right one? Okay. And furthermore, here is a slide, you know, this and this are the same. Basically, in this particular case, I put all the objects. So all the examples are divided in terms of, are characterized in terms of two attributes, x1 and x2. Okay, and then an example is 0 if it is, I guess, positive, and across if it is negative. So this is another way of showing the example. Okay, and then if that is the case, if it's a binary classification learning scenario, then all you need to find is a surface separating the positives from the negatives. So the question here is, you know, this is the same exact picture. Okay. So should I be separating it by putting this line, or this curve, or this even nicer curve? Which one should I use? Yeah. But this is really a 2D problem. So because there are only two dimensions, two variables, so it's only a 2D problem. If you have NRE, so if you have examples defined in terms of N attributes, then these points would be points in n-dimensional space. And then these would be an n-dimensional plane. N-dimensional, those are, that's why you call it not plane, surface. So n-dimensional surface which separates the positives from the negatives. Notice that learning can be more general than positives and negatives. It can be multiple possible values. So for example, you might have a concept which has multiple values. So it is grade A, grade B, grade C, grade D, grade E. Okay, and so given the example, you should be able to guess whether it should be A or a B or a C or a D or a E. And if you increase the number of prediction values, then in the end you will come to a function learning where for each example there is a separate value, which is the Y value. Here, in fact, really for each example, the Y value is either 0 or 1. So that's why it's easier to show just as a decision surface. Both of these are sort of equivalent views, okay? So the real question is, should I be looking for these or these or these? Okay, now you might think this is just an issue for this problem. Let me see. Here is Russell's restaurant waiting scenario, right? Now, should I be trying to predict Russell's restaurant waiting scenario using something called neural network, decision trees, association rules, naive-Bayes classifiers, k-nearest neighbors, support vector machines, radial basis functions, what? Which one should I use? So the point I'm trying to make is the problem was still not well specified enough. We assumed it's sort of ready to start solving the problem. But really, to the extent if you think all of these are equally good, then I have nothing to argue with you. But if you start thinking that, you know, really, maybe one of them is better than the other. Okay. Now the question is, how could you actually care about one decision surface being better than the other? In particular, how many of you think that the best way to separate the positives from negatives here is this way? The interesting thing about this is I made sure that all crosses are this side and all O's are the other side. Not a single training example has been misclassified by this. Not a single training example has been misclassified. Okay? Looks like done good. It's like, you know, obviously compared to that, this guy misclassifies here. There is a plus which is on the other side. There is a zero which is on this side. So it's kind of misclassifying some of them of the training example. Which one do you think is better? Just go with your intuition for now. What do you think if you are stuck with this and you're trying to separate positives from negatives? What? Why? No, but the point is, if in fact all you are interested in doing is finding the surface that exactly classifies the training examples correctly, which would you pick? This one. Right? And yet, you don't want to pick that. Because learning is not about past. Learning is about future. Learning is not about being correct on the training example. It's about being correct on the test example. And to the extent you believe that this is not as good as this, it's because you are thinking that while you are completely classifying the training examples correctly, right, you have in some sense overfitted, and this is a very descriptive term and it's actually the technical term too, you have overfitted your decision surface so close that it's not likely to generalize. It's likely to not only learn the true difference between positives and negatives, but also the teacher sticks. You know, if teacher has made a small mistake, you would actually get that. And you will repeat it forever and ever. Okay? And none of you do that. I mean, you once in a while show me, hey, Rao, there is a mistake on the slide. And it's because you are not taking anything, everything I give as words from, you know, absolute power of authority. I don't like this, but, you know, that's good. That's why you don't take it and you are happy. Okay? So, it's because you are not trying to make sure that I will just take snapshots of these slides. But you're hoping that by understanding the slides, you'll do well in the exam. And if I made a mistake here, I'm not likely to make the same mistake on the exam. I will still penalize you if you didn't understand it. Right? And so you don't overfit. So that's one thing. In fact, this discussion actually brings into consideration a very interesting connection between learning and compression. Okay? Think of this alternate view of learning, where you have a bunch of points, right? Now, once I curve fit, you know, curve fitting is another name for functional learning. Once I fit a curve to these points, what's the great advantage of it? Instead of all the points, I just now have to remember this little curve, which has a nice analytical description. Okay? So, in particular, suppose I have a huge number of, suppose I have here's those are my points. You could make a nice big table and remember all the points. Okay? Or you can just fit a line to it and remember the equation of the line, which takes less space. Equation of the line. You compress the heck out of the data. So learning is connected to compression, obviously, but there is a difference. If you are interested in lossless compression, this is not a lossless compression because it's actually giving, for example, for the point here, it's saying the true value is this, but in fact the true value is that. There's an error. Okay? And so if you want to provide lossless compression, that might wind up. In this case, actually, you try to do lossless compression. This is lossless compression of this data. And what we are arguing right now is, while compression and learning are well connected, the critical difference is, when push comes to shove, you're really interested in your performance on the test data, not on the training data. Okay? So, if you are exactly correct on all the training data, that still doesn't help you. And even if you actually, so that's an important point to remember, that compression and learning are connected, and because of which everything you learn for learning can also be used for compression, and vice versa. If you have an idea for compression, you could possibly use it for learning. More or less, you would be surprised that somebody has already done it. For every possible type of reasonable compression algorithms, there's a learning algorithm based on that. Okay. So the bigger issue is really that I'm saying, even though I know what inductive learning is, I know all the training examples, and I know that all I need is finding a hypothesis that fits the data best, I'm still not done, because where are my hypotheses coming from? For a guy who is looking for lines, he would find a line here. Okay? And in fact, there are hilarious, I don't remember whether I mentioned it to you or not, but there are hilarious examples of how various people try to find lines where lines don't exist. So for example, if you have, let's say, a sine wave, right? Here is a nice line which goes through it. And these are just errors. Count anything that's not falling on your hypothesis to be errors. You can always fit a line. If you are interested in fitting a line, believe me, you'll fit a line. Okay? If you are interested in fitting a higher order curve, believe me, you can fit a higher order curve too. More interestingly, if I have a bunch of data and I say you can fit to it any polynomial up to degree k, then in trying to find, notice that the polynomials of degree k, when k greater than 1, include lines as a special case. Okay? So in some sense, the guy who is looking for lines has a smaller space of hypothesis. The guy who is also looking for lines and curves, you know, where the curve is, let's say, you know, quadratic curve, has a bigger space of hypothesis. In particular, who made you look for lines? What in the data told you that you should be looking for lines? Did I say there's a line there? No. And for that matter, who made you look for decision trees in this data? Are neural nets in this data? Are naive-based classifiers in this data? The data is what the data is. Where did you come up with this extra information as to what you should be looking for? The answer is, there is no such thing as pure inductive learning. All inductive, remember previously we said pure inductive learning just starts with training examples and looks to find the pattern. The question is, in trying to find the pattern, you have to narrow your attention to some set of patterns you are looking for. And see, of those patterns, which is the one that is best suited to the data. And the technical term for this is hypothesis. Okay? So you made a hypothesis first that this data has lines. And once you decided that the hypothesis, so when you made a bias that this data has lines, so your hypothesis space would be the space of all straight lines. And fitting a line to your data then is finding the best among all those lines that fits the data, in terms of obviously reducing the false negatives and false positives. Okay? So the question is, the real inductive learning looks more like this. Training examples which are given as labeled, and you're going to, and you in some sense have a space of hypothesis. And this space of hypothesis really is your bias. This is what you're looking for in the data. Okay? And you're going to look for each of the hypotheses in this space and see which of them best matches the data in terms of like reducing the false positives and false negatives. Okay? And output that hypothesis. This is bias, because bias is any knowledge other than the training examples that's used to restrict the space of hypothesis considered. If you don't use any bias, the hypothesis should be, there could be a line, there could be, so basically there could be any possible curve. If it is real number data, then you should be willing to consider any possible curve. Polynomials, transcendental, everything. Okay? And considering that means that you also have to argue to yourself that the one that you pick is the best among all of them. Okay? So it's worth thinking about, and given that this slide, I mean, sort of tells you probably if you read ahead in the textbook or if you heard about machine learning before, these are all the various types of machine learning algorithms you might have come across. You know, the Bayesian trees, the neural networks, the naive-based classifiers. I'm saying these are all just different biases. Russell didn't say I use neural networks in my brain. We just are looking for one. Okay, and once we decide we're looking for neural networks, we look for the best neural network that's going to fit the data. Okay? So the question then is, it's worth thinking about the splendors of biases. So there's like a, this part is still, you sort of need to understand that, you know, the type of biases that learning algorithms can use. And then we can start using, for each type of bias, there is a specific algorithm that's good at finding the best hypothesis with respect to that bias. Okay? So here is like the critical missing link that we didn't talk about previously. Okay? There are biases that we use all the time in real life, and I have mentioned this in the back in the past. Here are some examples. Gavgai example, I told you that if you are in a foreign country standing at the edge of a field and a, an animal just bounces in front of you and the foreign guy behind you says, Gavgai. And he or she could be meaning any possible thing by saying Gavgai there. And yet we all jump to the conclusion, most of us will jump to the conclusion that the thing that just jumped in front of you is Gavgai. Okay, why is that? That's because we have a bias. We jump to conclusions even though the data does not warrant it. And if you wait for the data to warrant conclusions, you would still be waiting in nursery. You know, forget about nursery, you won't even get to nursery because there are not enough samples in the world which will give you enough data before you can be sure. So in a way, much of what happened when we came into the world is we have biases worked in. And the language has a bias. We mentioned last time the universal grammar is a bias. And so when we are hearing these crazy sounds and noises, you're trying to fit the closest human language to those. I don't know, I haven't done this experiment, but it would be interesting to see if you put a human baby in, you know, in a scenario where there is no human language. There's like a bunch of, wolves and, birds talking to each other. So my hypothesis, and NSF is going to kill me if I try to propose this as an experiment, my hypothesis is that we're going to, that the baby will actually fit the closest human language, as given by the, universal grammar to what it's hearing. So this is one way of figuring out which language sounds like, ducks quacking. So you put a kid only with ducks and see what they speak. And if they start speaking English, you know that English sounds like ducks. But anyway, so just one example of bias. So basically whole object bias is one, and then the universal grammar is one. The other thing is Brazilian. So why Brazilian? So you just went to Sao Paulo, okay, which is a Brazilian city. Got off the plane, and you have no clue. Are there any Brazilians here? My God, we are not diverse at all. So you have no clue about the country. So you got down, and then the first guy comes across to you is wearing a red shirt, blue pants, and is wearing and holding a stick, and is speaking in Portuguese. One example till now, that's it. One person you saw who's speaking Portuguese, wearing red shirt, blue pants, blah, blah, blah. Most people would jump to the conclusion that Brazilians speak Portuguese. And I would be very surprised if any of you jumped to the conclusion that Brazilians wear red shirts or blue pants. Why? Those hypotheses are exactly as well matched with the single example you have as the example which says Brazilians speak, as the hypothesis which says Brazilians speak Portuguese. Why? Because it turns out there is a bias. The bias in this case is prior knowledge. We, for example, know that nationalities seem to affect language spoken, but nationalities don't seem to affect color of the clothes. Not as much. Okay? If you think of it in terms of database terms, it's a functional dependency between the attribute values. Okay? So nationality attribute seems to be determining the language attribute strongly, whereas the nationality attribute is not determining the color of the shirt attribute as strongly. Based on your prior knowledge, it has nothing to do with Brazil. And so when you went to the Brazil, you were able to actually quickly jump to the conclusion that these guys all speak Portuguese. Okay? Again, a bias at work. Okay. So the question is, what are the kinds of biases? There are broadly two types of biases, obviously. Domain-independent bias or domain-specific bias. Okay? A domain-independent bias has nothing to do with the specific problem at hand. Okay? So for example, you may have syntactic biases of the form, look for lines. When in doubt, look for a line. And so you can always find a line in the data. Just consider enough points to be noisy and then you'll find a line. Okay? Or look for naive-based classifier. Or doing the whole object bias. That means whatever somebody is referring to must be the referent must be to the entire object filling up my visual field. Okay. Another version of the syntactic bias is, so in fact, we will be talking a lot about these syntactic biases. So for example, looking for Dacian trees is a syntactic bias. Looking for association rules is another syntactic bias. Looking for naive-based classifiers is yet another one. Looking for neural nets is yet another one. Okay. Now my question is, which is the right one to look for? If you ever ask yourself this question and keep thinking there must be an obvious answer I'm forgetting, you know, hit yourself hard on the back of your head because there is no answer. It depends. It's a bias, and to the extent the bias is domain independent, there is no real reason why one particular syntactic bias is any better than other one. In fact, we'll see, you know, in the class today and next and tomorrow that the same bias might wind up doing pretty good for one concept and pretty bad for another concept. And the relative performance between two biases could change. For example, the classic case is a simple type of neural network winds up performing much worse than Dacian tree for one type of concept and much better than Dacian tree for another type of concept. So it depends on what function you are trying to learn. And knowing about the domain tells you what kind of functions might you be learning. Okay, but in some sense, bias is what you have before you saw the data. Okay, and this is, outside of this class, bias is always used in a negative connotation. You know, you're not supposed to have bias. But in essence, if you want to learn at all, you have to have bias. Okay, because otherwise it's just too hard. So syntactic bias, and there's a preference bias. Even among these biases, you might be saying, look for the smaller Dacian trees versus larger ones. Look for the smallest polynomial that will fit the data versus look for the polynomial that will fit the data the best. Okay? This is mostly what we'll be talking about in this class. Here is another whole side of biases, which is basically domain-specific bias, which is sort of dependent on the prior knowledge. Okay. So for example, any knowledge that you have about the domain is biased. It's going to make you consider certain hypotheses more likely than other hypotheses. Okay. So any background theories and explanations that you have about the domain will help you decide which aspects of the example might be connected to which aspects of the example might be connected to its label. So for example, in the Russell domain, suppose if one of the features is the color of the watch he is wearing, If you know anything about how people go to restaurants, even if you don't know anything about how Russell goes to restaurants, you have a very good reason to believe that his waiting or not waiting at the restaurant is not likely to depend upon the color of the watch. That's only because we know that there is some background knowledge that we have, you know, that sort of tells us how people go to restaurants. Whereas something like the wait time at the restaurant, you're more likely to leave it alone because you think that's connected to whether people will or will not wait. Now, the relative weights that are given to the different features may be different. Some people just like waiting. Okay, I mean, there's this joke about English that they, in the weekend outing for them, is to go stand in a line, and when they reach the window, change to the next line. Because just the standing in the queue itself is interesting. Okay, but most people, for a specific person, the weight for the different features may be different, but you still may be able to tell whether features are generally likely to be relevant or not relevant, okay, using the domain knowledge. And in fact, somebody helped you when you got only these features about the Russell problem. That's because somebody helped you by removing many of the irrelevant features outside already. So in a way, I'm already biasing my learner by describing the example with only a certain number of features and not others. And we mentioned this last time. What is listed in the description of the example is just as important as what's not listed. What's not listed means somebody decided it's irrelevant. So background theories and explanations can play the role of bias. Weak domain theories, even if you don't have complete domain theories, even if you have meta-domain theories, saying these things seem to influence these things. So functional determination, that would be helpful too, because I just pointed out that in the Brazil case, knowing that nationality seems to affect the language was enough, even if you didn't know which nationality corresponds to which language. Okay, so in the Brazil case, you could either have known upfront that Brazilians speak Portuguese from the beginning. And so when you got down, you see this guy speaking Portuguese, you say, yeah, that makes sense. I'm able to explain why this guy is speaking Portuguese. Okay? Or you may only know that nationality affects language, and so based on this particular example guy speaking Portuguese, you now jump to the conclusion that all Brazilians speak Portuguese. Okay. So the another thing, the color of the skin determines the degree of sunburn. That's another high level, weak domain theories that we might have. Okay. And finally, of course, you might just know that basically all of these help you in the classification scenarios of the kind we're looking at in deciding what features are relevant and what features are not relevant. That's another obvious thing. And the moment you remove some features, you're removing some hypothesis from consideration. Okay. Now, biases have obvious connections to the cost of learning with those biases. Okay, if you have strong biases, it's very easy to learn in terms of cost of learning. So for learning algorithms, there are two different issues. One is, how long does it take for the learner to come up and say, I have learned it? And the second issue is, how well do they do in the exam? Okay, So a learner can quickly declare, I have learned my concept. In some sense, what it's saying is, I have found the best hypothesis in my hypothesis space that fits the data. So I'm now ready for the test. And might as well take the test now because I'm not going to change anything because my hypothesis space is small. So if I was only looking for lines, I'm a line learner, I'm going to learn a line. And even if the actual data is this, I will learn a line. And the best line for this data happens to be this. Okay, would you guys agree? I mean, even among the lines, like this is not as good a line for this data. This winds up being the best line. So I would have picked this line and said, this is my best guess. And, you know, start bringing me your test. And then I'll bring the test examples. And this guy obviously won't do too well. So by learning cost, I'm talking about how long does it take to look at your space of hypothesis and pick up the best one. And learning accuracy, I'm talking about how are you going to do on the test examples. These are completely different things. Okay? So if you have strong biases, you have a much smaller hypothesis space. Much smaller hypothesis space. Now, sometimes the hypothesis space can be infinitely large and still could be smaller than another infinitely larger hypothesis space. We understand that. Like the space of light is smaller than the space of up to second degree polynomial, which is smaller than the space of up to third degree polynomial, just because, you know, the Cantor's idea that, you know, as long as you can provide a one-to-one correspondence in one way and not the other way, one set is bigger than the other set. Okay? So a strong learner, a strong biased learner has smaller hypothesis space, and so it's going to have a lower learning cost because it has a fewer ones that it needs to bring and compare to the examples and see which is the best one. Okay? And so you may be able to actually differentiate between the examples, differentiate between your hypothesis, just very few examples. Very few examples, in fact. Okay? So this is my example. Suppose if I decided that the hair length determines pass and fail grade in the class. I just decided this. Okay? I mean, in this case, I'm learning your grade just based on your features. So if I decided, my strong bias is that hair length explains everything. And this is not surprising because some years back people used to have this pseudoscience called phrenology, which would be saying that some weird patterns on the head explain everything about you. Right? And there is still palmistry, which says different weird patterns on your hand explain everything about you. Okay, so there are all sorts of crazy biases. So mine is as good. So if mine, I've decided that the hair length explains your grade. So I'm very quickly, so you'll give me 15 students with their grades. So I will very quickly fit, and I'll say hair length is short, medium, long. That's it. Only three values. And so I will be very quickly able to predict in my limited hypothesis space the best fit hypothesis. I'll be done fast. And obviously, on the test cases, I might be pretty badly off. But on the training, I'll be done very fast. Okay? Cuts down the concepts you can, however, of course, this also shows that the cuts down, that by having strong biases, you're going to cut down the concepts you can learn accurately. It doesn't come easy. You know, you're basically getting done fast learning, but then what did you learn? Okay? So the likelihood is that you may not actually have learned the real concept. You may have learned something else, which is basically the closest. So the quick, one important issue in this case is, what if my bias is so strong that the true concept is not in my hypothesis space at all? Which is very likely the case. Much of pseudoscience, you know, we used to think that everything can be explained by some random thing which we no longer believe now because we have more scientific explanations. That was because we essentially at that time have very strong biases, and it turned out that the true explanation was not even, the true hypothesis was not even in the space of hypothesis you were considering. Okay, so for example, think of Salem witch hunts, right? You know, those of you who are not from US know, may not know this, but Salem witch hunts was the scenario where people decided that a particular, I think what was plague, right? What was the disease that was, it was some sort of a disease that was spreading, it had to be spreading because of people being witches. And they came up with beautiful explanations because there are 5-6 people who are not getting sick and everybody else is getting sick. And so, you know, these were before flu shots and plague shots, and so they assumed that the guys who are not getting sick, they must be the guys who are making other people sick. And, you know, huge number of such people were killed and they were hunted down. And the problem was, their goal was laudable. Their goal was trying to figure out what is causing the disease. But their hypothesis space they were considering wound up not having the correct hypothesis, which we only knew much, much later as to how diseases progress and what in fact was happening to these people who were dying. Okay? So the problem with the strong biases is that if it is too small a space, it's likely that the true concept is not even in the space. But the good thing is you'll get done fast. Okay? And the other interesting thing is strong bias means fewer parameters for describing the hypothesis itself. a line requires fewer parameters to describe than a second order polynomial. A second order polynomial requires fewer parameters than the third order polynomial, and so on. Okay. And in fact, you can actually show that the actual, this is not just wishy-washy social learning, I mean social discussion. You can actually show that the complexity, the sample complexity of a learning task is proportional to logarithm of the size of the hypothesis space you are considering for discrete hypothesis spaces. There's a version of this theorem, I mean, there's a version of this statement for continuous hypothesis spaces such as lines, okay? But if you're only considering discrete hypothesis spaces, so for example, suppose you are considering the space of Boolean functions of n attributes. How many Boolean functions of n attributes are there? What is a Boolean function of n attributes? For a function of n attributes, you have a nice big table like this. It has 1, etc., up to nth column corresponding to each of the attributes. And then there is the function value column. Right? How many rows are there in this table? 2 power n, because they are Boolean attributes. For each row, you can independently put true and false to get a separate function. So how many Boolean functions are there? 2 power n. So if you're just considering the space of all Boolean functions of n attributes, I have a, for just 6 Boolean attributes, 6 Boolean attributes, I have these many hypotheses. Okay? I just applied that number there, that's all, 2 power 6. Learning isn't easy. So what do you do? If you are assuming, if you have a, you know, if the Russell example was basically a bunch of n Boolean attributes, you're essentially talking about 2 power n hypothesis. And you have to consider each of them compared to the examples to see which of them is the best hypothesis. Even if you spend like a unit time, a small unit time for each hypothesis, you're dead. Now it turns out that in fact you can show that the best, even the best learning algorithms would need to see at least the logarithm of the size of the hypothesis space before they have a chance of learning the concept in the PAC sense. You remember the PAC sense, the probably approximately correct learner? To learn a concept in probably approximately correct sense, the number of hypotheses that you require can be shown to be less than, is bounded by 1 by epsilon times log of 1 by delta plus log of h. Epsilon and delta make sense. The more tighter your epsilon and delta parameters are, the more examples you need to see. Right? Because the more tighter the epsilon delta, then the more perfect your learner has to be, the more examples you have to see. What's very interesting is this term here, log of h, which is the size of the hypothesis space. Okay? If you're learning Boolean functions, log of 2 power n is still 2 power n. So you will be requiring exponential number of examples in the worst case to differentiate, to find the best hypothesis. So what are we going to do? What we could do is have a bias. My bias is conjunctive concept. Suppose I assumed, without giving any reason, that you must be trying to teach me not any random Boolean function, but a conjunctive Boolean function. The conjunctive Boolean function is of the form literal 1 and literal 2, etc., and literal k, where each literal is an attribute A or the negation of that attribute. It's obvious that conjunctive functions are subset of all Boolean functions. The question is, how smaller they are? How many conjunctive functions are there? How many conjunctive functions are there? In each conjunction, each feature can either appear positively, appear negatively, or not appear at all. So each guy has three possibilities in the conjunction you are considering. So 3 power n is the number of conjunctive functions. 3 power n is the number of conjunctive functions. What's log of 3 power n? It's order n. So if you have a bias, if you have a bias that what I'm trying to teach you must be a conjunctive function, you would be able to get done much faster, because you'll only be looking over 3 power n possible hypotheses. And we know that if you are smart enough, you will be able to devise an algorithm which would require remember, this is a lower bound. The number of examples that you need is at least this many. Okay, so if you're really, really smart, you will be able to get this bound. So for 3 power n, if you're really smart, you should be able to write a polynomial time learning algorithm. But I never told you that I was trying to teach you conjunctive functions. You essentially just had a bias, because it helps you in this case. You wind up doing less amount of work. Okay? So strong bias is fewer parameters, and in fact it does theoretically less amount of work. It turns out there is a nice argument similar to this for curves and lines too. Okay? Except you can't do log of the space of curves, because it's log of infinity. Turns out there's an equivalent idea called VC dimension, which I won't talk about. Lapnik-Chernovinkis dimension, which gives you sort of the expressiveness of a hypothesis space. And the VC dimension of the space of lines winds up being smaller than the VC dimension of the space of second order polynomials. Okay, any questions? Okay, so the last but one point I want to make about bias is, let's see, we already talked about bias can increase or reduce learning cost. I also want to talk about bias can increase or reduce learning accuracy. Okay, and that was this picture we were looking at. And you sort of agreed that for this, probably this is the best hypothesis. And this is probably not a good hypothesis, this is probably not a good hypothesis. What's interesting is the space of lines is smaller than the space of, let's say, the smooth, circular curve. The space of circular curves is smaller than the space of wiggly curves, because this is a much higher order polynomial to get this. Okay? We are saying the previous one essentially made it sound as if you have a strong bias, then you'll get done, but you may learn badly. But we are saying that's true, but if you have a very weak bias, you will take a long time to get done, and you will also do badly, which is worse. Right, I mean, the guy who's looking for lines will at least be done faster, even though he fails in the exam. The guy who's looking for really curvy lines may not even get done preparing for the exam. And if he ever gets done preparing for the exam, we'll take the test and may actually fail. That's what we are saying. Okay? So this is actually a beautiful trade-off in learning that is called bias and variance trade-off. So if you can see this picture, this blue line is the amount of error made by the learner as it keeps finding better and better hypotheses to fit the data. Obviously, it keeps reducing. As you find more and more hypotheses that fit the data exactly, it keeps reducing. So, if you look at this, the blue line is sort of high, you know, the line sort of falls somewhere here, this guy falls somewhere here because it's much lower, and this sort of falls somewhere in between. In terms of the error on the training data. But you don't get badges for error on the training data. You only get badges for error on the test data. How does the test data error work with respect to the same axis? What we are in essence saying is, it's high here because this is bad, and it could also be high here because this is bad too. So in some sense, it's likely to reach a minimum and start worsening again. So in the beginning, you are doing badly because you have too strong a bias, and here you're doing badly because you're trying to overfit to the data. You have such a large hypothesis space that you can pick noise as well as the data. Okay? And so, in essence, having a weak bias allows us to capture more concepts, yeah, but because it has a larger space, it increases the learning cost, which also makes sense. But much sort of surprising is it might lead to overfitting. If in fact you spend a lot of time and do work on the test. Okay? And so really the best bias for your problem is a tricky concept. If you're too strongly biased, you do badly. If you're too weakly biased, you do badly. And the best bias is sort of somewhere in between, which winds up just capturing the concept that you're trying to learn and very little else. That's what you'd hope. Okay? So, in a way, whenever I'm talking about bias in all these cases, it could be bias of decision trees, bias of naive-Bayes classifiers, any of these, the bias with neural networks and so on. So this is just a summary of what we just said about biases. Biases are essential for survival, otherwise you can't learn anything. Even Boolean functions cannot be learned with polynomial number of examples. Okay? So you need to make biases. You need to jump so that you can actually get by with fewer number of examples. Okay? The way you can do it is either to kind of restrict the hypothesis space, saying I'm only looking for, you know, lines or something, or use the domain knowledge to restrict the possible hypothesis that you would consider. Okay, and this is true also, in fact, remember there was a mail I sent some time back about, I don't know how many of you actually even opened this, but there is a study in Economist by Josh Tenenbaum and his colleagues at MIT Behavior Brain Science Lab talking about Bayesian priors, that people tend to have prior information about the Bayesian priors, the prior probability distribution about various types of events. And they use that to very quickly jump to conclusions even with very few examples. Bias is actually great because it allows you to learn from fewer examples. It's important because, as I said, if you want to wait for all the examples to come before you can learn the best hypothesis and you have very weak bias or you have no bias, then you die because you won't have learned anything. Okay? So it's very important for survival of us as well as of our programs because they're not going to be computationally going to survive if they don't have biases. But then again, biases put blinders on the learner. Okay? There is extra information that you're throwing in. In fact, in normal social discourse, you have negative connotations for words like bias. You can't use bias in a good way, in a sentence. Okay? You cannot tell your friend, you're so biased, and expect him not to slap you silly. Okay? And similarly, you cannot tell your friend, oh my God, you're so prejudiced, and not expect to be slapped silly. prejudice is before hearing the evidence, already making up your mind partly based on prior knowledge. Okay? And those are important, but then they also have this problem, because if you have the wrong biases, you don't do well. You feel as if you've done quick learning, but you basically got useless performance. So the classic biases here, two ones I put there, is God doesn't play dice with the universe, is Einstein's bias, who basically he used that to say quantum mechanics can't be right. And Niels Bohr once seemed to have said to Einstein, don't tell God what to do. Okay, because, you know, mind your own business. You know, why are you going around telling God you shouldn't play dice? You know, if God is playing dice, God is playing dice. So his point being, I mean, the more interesting point here being that Einstein had essentially assumed that certain types of explanations are not possible for physical phenomena. Upfront, a priori, without any evidence for one way or other. Okay? And it cuts down the number of things he has to look for. For example, he doesn't have to understand quantum mechanics, which is, you know, if enough of you who took quantum mechanics know, it's not worth really understanding. It's too costly, you know, in terms of brain power. But on the other hand, he paid for it. To the extent, in fact, God does play dice in terms of actual test cases. He wound up being wrong. You know, he was our smartest learner, and he screwed up because of the biases. And then this other one, I forget when it was, it's not recently, but I think Bill Bennett once had some interesting thing about color of the skin is reasonably relevant in predicting crime. Okay, and again, one of these causations being mixed up with correlations and vice versa. Correlations being mixed up with causations. The moment you believe this, you're going to look for explanations and hypotheses which may actually be wrong. Okay. By the way, I did send a long mail about, I mean, I more or less argued in this class that it's good to have biases mostly, okay, and that it's good to stereotype, and it's good to be prejudiced. But I did send a separate mail, I think, last week about the social consequences and how to make sense of the other type of advice that you're given, that don't stereotype, don't use biases in at least social context. Okay, but you should understand both. But computationally, you definitely should understand that bias is not a bad thing necessarily. It's a question of using it right. Okay. So I'm going to use one bias today, which is I'm going to find decision trees in this example. That's all I'm going to do. Okay. And then we go home. So decision tree is essentially, decision tree bias is 20 questions, AI style. Okay, so if I get to ask questions on each of the, so you have the example in front of you, and you get to ask these 20 questions. So is it round or square? Is it cuddly or not cuddly? And then you keep asking these questions, and, you know, if you can guess what it is without asking too many questions, you win the game. Right? And in fact, I think there is a little thingy that they sell now. What is that thingy called? He knows everything. What?
20 questions.
20 questions. I mean, a little thing which actually you can guess whatever it is that you are guessing, and then it tries to come close to what you are guessing with just 20 questions. What? It's reasonably well.
Yeah.
Decision tree algorithm. Okay, I mean, it's not exactly decision tree algorithm, but so let's understand, if I get to ask, given a random example that I have in my hand, and I know whether Russell waited or not waited for that example. You get to ask me questions. So something like, so is the price high or low? Or is the restaurant type French or not French? You get to ask these kinds of questions. The issue is, can you come up with a sequence of questions, and based on the questions, you know, a 20 questions algorithm has to have like a flowchart like this. It decides to ask a bunch of questions. So for example, this one is saying, I'll ask whether patrons, what's the value of patrons attribute? If it says none, the answer is no. If it says some, the answer is yes. If it says full, then I have another question. And if it is, then my second question is weight estimate. Okay? And if the wait estimate is greater than 60, which is more than an hour, the answer is no, he won't wait. Okay? If it is between half an hour and 60, then I'll have some more questions to ask you. If it is less than 10 minutes, the answer is unequivocally yes. I have a nice little flow chart here, which tells me, given an example, whether it's supposed to correspond to a positive or a negative example for Russell waiting in the restaurant. Now it turns out in this particular case, I can tell you that this particular decision tree is consistent with all these examples. Okay, so I mean I can't show it to you right now, but go home, look at these examples, look at this picture, and see if it did in fact correctly classify all the examples. Training example, it did. Now, an interesting question to ask is, if this is decision tree representation. Now, basically, if you think of these attributes as Boolean attributes, which is a small special case, currently we have actually multi-valued, but suppose you consider Boolean attributes. For the case of Boolean attributes, how restrictive are decision trees? Can you write any arbitrary Boolean function as a decision tree or not? Turns out, they are not restrictive at all. Decision trees can represent any arbitrary Boolean function. Which isn't good, because I just told you that if you are learning from a hypothesis space which includes all Boolean functions, then you would need exponential number of examples. And yet, decision trees are used all the time. Why? Because we are not going to look for the best hypothesis. We are going to look through the hypothesis in a greedy fashion, more like a hill climbing, more like a greedy search. So you just construct one decision tree, top to bottom, and say, this is it, take it. I'm not going to prove to you that this is the best decision tree among all possible decision trees, because proving that would force me to consider 2 power n Boolean functions, which I know is dead on arrival. So one way decision trees essentially use, so decision tree bias is one where you say preference bias. You would just assume upfront that smaller decision trees are better, which makes sense. So if there are two decision trees which both are correctly explaining the training examples, you go with the one which is asking fewer questions. Okay? Now, it's actually a very interesting question as to why it makes sense. We always seem to believe this, that if there is a simpler explanation, go with it. Okay? It turns out that, in fact, I can generate a concept which, in fact, does not correspond to the simplest decision tree that you would come up with. Okay? And I'll give you, in the homework, a very simple example involving Seinfeld characters going to a party. And you're trying to guess based on who is present in the party whether they are likely to be, whether it's going to be a successful party or not. Okay? As simple as it can get, and it turns out that the simplest decision tree there winds up not being as good. Okay? But it's a bias. You know that when you have a bias, you take the hit, but you make it to get by fast. Okay? So the assumption in decision tree learning, so the normal learning for decision trees is, pick an attribute. If you have all the examples in front of you, pick an attribute, split the examples in terms of that attribute. So an attribute has 5 values, then split all the examples having first value into one group, second value into another group, third value into another group, fourth and fifth. So you have now 5 bags instead of one bag of examples. Each bag contains some positive examples, some negative examples. Okay, if it only contains all positives, you're done, because that bag, answer is yes. If it only contains all negative examples, you're done. That bag, answer is no. If it contains positives and negatives, you're not done yet. You have to recursively split those examples again by picking another feature. Okay, that's all. That's the algorithm. And clearly, this is not an optimal algorithm because it's greedily picking a feature. It's not comparing one decision tree to another decision tree. It's upfront constructing what it thinks is the best decision tree. That's why it can get by even though there are 2^2 n examples. Now the only question, of course, is the only interesting part about decision tree learning is how do you pick the attributes? Now it turns out that we have to agree that between two decision trees, both of which are consistent with the example, which do you think is nicer? Smaller one. Why? Because you think fewer questions, the better. Okay. So if you are into asking the fewest questions possible, in this example, I can split the original examples are these are positives, these are negatives. I can split it into patterns, split using patterns, and I would get these three bags. I'll split using type of the restaurant. I'll get these four bags. Which would you split? What? Patterns. You didn't need to know. I mean, you know 20 questions. You know, ask questions which will get you answers quickly. So this way you're done, this way you're done. There's a probability that you will get, this way and this way you're done. This is all negative, so this is, minus is the answer here. All positive, plus is the answer here. This one you need to recursively split. Now this is only a greedy solution. It could well be that in fact, right after this, there's one test which tells you exactly how to do, you know, take these apart, whereas there is none there. But if you're making local decisions, all greedy algorithms make local decisions. If you're making local decisions, this is as good a decision as you can make. So the question is, can I then, instead of drawing a picture and showing it to you for each possible splitting, can I just come up with some number which will say patterns is 5 good, type is 4 good, and 5 is better than 4, 5 is bigger than 4, so I pick 5. So I'll show you the main idea here. It's very simple, but then we'll come back and quickly discuss it next class beginning. All you're going to do is you're going to use an idea called entropy of a set of mutually exclusive and exhaustive events. Okay? So if I have a set of events E1 to EK, one of which is going to happen. One of which is going to happen. You don't know which one is going to happen. And E1 is likely to happen with probability P1, etc. EK is likely to happen with probability PK. Then I would define the information content of somebody who comes to tell me which is likely to happen. Okay? I would define the money that I'm going to pay them or the information content of finding the answer as to which event is actually going to occur as this expression. Summation of minus PI log PI. Okay, the first thing to understand is it makes sense. If you just have two events, then P1 and P2, P1 plus P2 must be equal to 1 because they are mutually exclusive and exhaustive. Which essentially means if I know P1, then the other one is 1 minus P1. If I compute this expression, minus P1 log P1 plus minus 1 minus P1 log 1 minus P1, you can see that it would be 0 here, 0 here, 0.5 here. That's just the expression. Okay? And I argue that it makes sense because if P1 is 0, that means event 1 will never occur. There is metaphysical certainty that event 1 will never occur. So if I'm now going to come and tell you, I'm going to tell you which is going to occur. Do you care? No. If P1 equal to 1, again the same thing, because P1 is always going to occur. So you don't need me to tell you. The only time you will need me to tell you what will occur is when P1 equal to 0.5, because that's where the maximum uncertainty is. And an example that you should remember is, if you're trying to start a weather service bureau, which is going to tell people whether sun is going to, whether it's going to be a rainy day or cloudy day tomorrow. Okay? And you're starting, you figured this out and you got a IPO, I mean you got a like business plan and you're going to start this job, this weather service bureau. You have three places where you can start it. Phoenix in summer, Chirapunji in pretty much any time of the year, and London pretty much any time of the year. In fact, not even summer. Phoenix, London, or Chirapunji. Where do you think you will actually make any money? Nobody comes in Phoenix asking you, is it going to be sunny tomorrow? Because they know it's sunny all the time. Nobody comes in Chirapunji to ask anybody anything because it's all the time raining. They can't even get out. Okay? London, on the other hand, is famous for saying, if you don't like the weather, stand still for a minute and it'll change. Okay? There is a lot of uncertainty about the weather. And that's when it's worth paying money for the information content. What I'm going to do in running this is use this expression where the events in the beginning, there are n plus positives and n minus negatives. Okay? And so the probability that if I pick a random one, it will be positive is n plus by n plus plus n minus. And it will be negative is n minus by n plus plus n minus. And so the information content of this is this expression for those probabilities. After splitting on some particular feature, I get n1 plus, n1 minus, n2 plus, n2 minus, nk plus, nk minus, which are three k different bags. I can compute the information content for each of these bags. And the probability that I will fall in this bag would be the size of this bag divided by the total size of all the bags. So I can compute the expected information content. And I pick the feature which reduces the information content the maximum. That's it. So it's a blindly computing these numbers at every level. Okay? Go look at the example in the textbook. I'll also do it in the class next time. And then after this, I will do naive Bayes classifier and then go on to neural networks. That's tomorrow.